Please silence all electronic devices.
Representatives Brawley, Sane, Hastings, Martin, Setzer, and Soka are recognized.
So the bottom line is, folks, there are a lot of bad people out there.
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approve this message.
You're fired!
You know, the guy that used to sit in this chair had a saying, if you think everybody's good, you ain't met everybody.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the American Tobacco Historic District in downtown Durham, it's Friday, July 28th, 2017. Thanks for checking out the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tiberi. With me in studio is Jay Price, WUNC's military reporter, here to discuss President Trump's manipulation of the press, an energy bill signed this week by Governor Cooper, and perhaps even some tales from abroad. Jay, thanks for being here.
Oh, glad to be here.
All right, let's begin in Washington, D.C., where Trump tweeted about transgender people in the military this week, announcing they would no longer be allowed to serve. This impromptu ban evidently came without Pentagon consultation and seemed to not please the Joint Chiefs. Let's begin with your reaction to this when you heard it. What did you initially make of it from a news standpoint?
Well, you know, obviously it's going to be big news anytime that somebody does something involving, you know, this is a human resource question, really.
Right.
And it is a massive number of people generally that you're talking about in the service. You're talking about 1.3 million service members.
You're talking about all service members.
Now, the number of transgender people who are in active duty, very small. Really hard cohort to study. The numbers range up and down from I've seen hundreds to, you know, mid four figures. Yeah. It seems like there's some sort of kind of center kind of coalescing around the idea that it's somewhere between 2,000 and 7,000 people in active duty. But, you know, when you're issuing kind of directives for human resources for 1.2 million people.
Right.
You know, maybe a tweet is not exactly the chosen method. You know, I've worked in shops with as few as three people, and you wouldn't want your fate decided and announced to you by tweet.
Right.
And it's not the right way to make rules that are subject to litigation in this case, which is likely where we're headed if this is implemented, and it probably will be from the tone of it.
Sure.
But let's back up a little bit and look at the notion of issuing an order like this by Twitter, as opposed to some legal method. A tweet is not a legal document. It's not a legal implementation. The order, is, if you want to call it an order, was issued in three different tweets. The first one, I'll read this so you'll see where this heads.
Okay.
It's kind of mysterious after the first one.
After
a consultation with my generals and military experts, please be advised that the United States government will not accept or allow... .. That's all.
And that was all for 8 minutes, I believe.
Nine minutes.
Okay.
And so, I mean, just right off the bat, it's like, okay, where's this headed? And, you know, the limitations of 140 characters may have never been more apparent. You know, there were reports that people in the Pentagon were, like, on pins and needles. Is he declaring war on North Korea? Is he declaring war on China? Who knows?
Right.
And
maybe, to be fair, he didn't know for those 9 minutes. I'm just kidding. I think.
But 9 minutes, you think, okay, you know, that it would be nothing for me to go 9 minutes between tweets. But you kind of envision, you get this weird scene in your head when you're kind of like thinking this thing through. Like, the Pentagon didn't know he's going to issue this order, apparently, or was planning to issue an actual executive order on this, apparently. But you get this kind of weird notion in your mind that they're now prepared. The military games out everything. If you've thought vaguely of some terrible thing that could happen in Haiti or Somalia or something, they've thought through it 46 different ways. Mm-hmm. And they've got plans that are formalized for any contingency you can think of. And so you kind of get this weird sense of, okay, there's this room where they're monitoring every little instantaneous thing out of the Kremlin, out of China. And now maybe there's this room where they're sitting around, like, just, you know, like vultures kind of looking down at their Twitter feeds, you know, and seeing what Trump is doing, because it might be the only way they can find out with any sort of speed. So they're
right.
Like, oh, you know, what is he? Okay, where's he? You know, they hit a button and there's like red lights going off everywhere. We better be ready. And then he announces this.
So one thought I have on the 9 minutes is that clearly this is a level of showmanship or of Trumpism, of the reality TV factor of this. I mean, he was building the suspense, even if it's in short order, whether it's for the Pentagon or his however many million followers. He has now 20 million followers. So that's just, I guess, one tangential note.
He's a master of that. He's a master of timing. Clearly he is a showman. And maybe it was that, or, you know, who knows? Maybe something really interesting came on Fox News and he had to stop and watch.
Maybe. But to the point of timing, I was, and I don't want to downplay this, it's not an order, as you called, this series of tweets. The timing of it, to me, you have to just consider everything that's going on. This failed attempt to roll back Obamacare, this constant consternation with the Attorney General Jeff Sessions, the Secretary of State, who we think is kind of off onto the side at this point. He's kind of stepped back. Rex Tillerson.
Rexit. Rexit, they're calling it.
Brexit to Rexit. So, I mean, this is more of a news judgment question than somebody who's covered the military for a long time. But it seems to me that throughout the last year and a half, we've seen from President Trump his ability to, you can call it dangle the shiny object, you can say drive the narrative in a different direction, but it's fairly unprecedented, maybe totally unprecedented, for a president to have a spat with an attorney general and a secretary of state at the same time, not over anything of major substance, not over something of a real scandal. And now we're talking about something that is totally, for the most part, unrelated. I mean, maybe you can draw a line between Tillerson and the transgender ban. What did you make of that? What did you make of the I'll use the word manipulation of just the press's attention and trying to steer things away from perhaps some bigger policy issues that have been playing out this week?
Well, I mean, you know, for starters, the healthcare thing hadn't totally failed.
It
was still in the Senate, and the Senate still was, you know, still a vote or two away from, you know, they took several swings mm-hmm. at it trying to get something to go through. And, you know, it was clear they were still going to, I think the skinny repeal was still out there. Which was taken down last night.
Right. Early this morning, Friday.
Yeah. And that's being credited or blamed on McCain, as, you know, you can take it. But there were, you know, three Republican votes against it. And you almost get the feeling McCain and Lindsey Graham had a discussion beforehand. Right. You know, if you want to get into, like, you know, seeing patterns that may or may not be there. You know, Lindsey Graham is saying, oh, yeah, I don't. You know, I think this is a really bad idea. You keep hearing him say negative things about it, and then he votes for it. You know, he's going to stay in the Senate. McCain, yeah. You know, his health is not good, obviously, right. And McCain might have taken a hit for the team here. The team being him and Graham. They're kind of they used to travel overseas together. I interviewed the two of them in Kabul once. Very informal thing, and they're, you know, just kind of yuck it up. You know, they're almost like a comedy team. They work together so yeah. smoothly. But, you know, again, kind of looping back to whether there was a pattern, whether there was intent here, who knows? You know, I've just given up kind of guessing of whether there's any sort of pattern or intent to what Trump does. I mean, he likes to sow chaos.
Right.
He's got a great timing for figuring out a moment to sow chaos. He also he seems to have trouble with restraint. And in this case, he's obviously dying for a win of some kind.
Right.
The healthcare thing wasn't looking great. He was getting a lot of distraction, you know, with the various kind of spats internally. But on the other hand, there's all this talk that he loves feeding these internal spats in the White House and keeping people kind of in suspense on his staff
right.
about where things are headed. I don't know. I mean, you know, this is one way of making it seem like he's delivering something for the base, but he hasn't really delivered anything. I mean, a tweet is not an order. It's not legally binding. There is a long way to go before anything is implemented from this that actually affects people other
right.
than psychologically. I mean,
right. And he can pull the reins back on this. He can just walk away from this at a later time. To me, again, that is why this was such a diversion, an obstacle, whatever you want to call it, for the press and for other people to pay attention to and to spend time on. I mean, there are only so many hours in the day. There's only so much news coverage that can be constructed. And it seemed to me with the Republican, I guess we'll call them divides, between over Obamacare and certainly we saw some senators coming to the defense of Jeff Sessions this week. This maybe was an effort to build better party unity or to bring, I use the word so. Let me ask you this. The time you've spent covering the military, going back 20 years, transgender people in the military, what experience have you had with covering any transgender members of the military, and or kind of a broader question, what have you heard along the lines of this being a problem?
Well, you know, okay, so his stated reasons in his tweets for doing this were, you know, the tremendous cost, you know, the, I think the word was tremendous that he used, and the disruption of it. People have been trying to kind of interpret disruption. The cost is not tremendous. You know, there are various estimates out there by, you know, credible organizations like RAND. RAND is not a partisan organization. It's not going to take sides on this. It did a study on it. And by the way, they estimated there was a range of between about 1,300 and 6,600 transgender people, you know, actively serving, and another 800 to 4,100 in the reserves. But they caution they're just estimates. You know, there just isn't good data on it. But the numbers are fairly, you know, pretty modest. The cost, you know, and not all these people are going to seek therapy that costs anything, or you know,
or
gender reassignment surgery.
Right. And is that elective? Sorry to interrupt you.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's not and the VA doesn't cover that. Or does the VA cover that? Do you know? I mean, I'm totally throwing you on the spot here.
No, I don't know.
Okay.
You know, the estimates of the cost of it, $4.2 million to $5.6 million in one study, $2.4 million to $8.4 million a year in another study. You know, so transgender people, a very small percentage of the active duty military, and a modest to small percentage of them would seek surgery. Disruption, you know, that's been interpreted as it might affect the number of troops who are ready and available because they've had therapy / surgery to go overseas for deployment. It would be negligible. We're talking a couple hundred people at the most,
right,
in any given year, unavailable, which is nothing compared to there's usually 100,000 and some odd on the rolls, and I think just in the Army, that can't go over for various reasons, you know, illness, et cetera.
Right.
So it's his logic, if you want to call it logic, just doesn't hold up. It's not there. Now, as far as my own experience dealing with transgender service members, no, none. I spent probably something on the order of a year, a little over a year embedded off and on in various places. But, you know, that was before the order that allowed them to serve openly,
yeah,
which was about 10 months ago.
Right.
So undoubtedly I was around some.
Sure.
They were laying low for obvious
right
reasons. Now they've been able to serve openly and, you know, basically they've unmasked themselves,
yeah,
in many cases and left themselves open to be identified and, you know, tossed out if this thing is implemented. So, I mean, just because the numbers are low doesn't mean people aren't suffering right now or,
yeah,
and aren't upset. I talked to a consultant yesterday who's an expert in LGBT issues in the workplace, and he's well connected with LGBT veterans in North Carolina. And he said, you know, they're all kind of shocked, upset, amazed, you know, the emotions that you would expect. But, you know, there also was like a small kind of silver lining to the cloud. He noted that a number of Republicans, a number of conservatives had come out and said, you know, Trump's just wrong on this, including Tom Tillis. And you know, it's hard not to have the sense that not only is Trump on the wrong side of history here, you know, public opinion is you know,
is moving in the other direction.
Yes. And when Tom Tillis says you're wrong on this, you know, president,
you're not losing to Susan Collins.
You're not just one step past being on the wrong side of history. You're a couple of steps gone. And, you know, this is, and, you know, I'm going to paraphrase the great philosopher Dave Chappelle. You got to pace yourself. It was kind of, it's part of his comedy routine. He's, you know, kind of expressing kind of bewilderment that things could move so quickly in public opinion for LGBT people. And he said, you know, there's going to be some setbacks. You got to pace yourself. Brown versus Board of Education was 50 years ago, and then somebody called me an N-word in traffic Tuesday, you know. So it's going to take a minute, right. I think, was his summation. And this is, this has the smell of a step backwards, and then there'll be two steps forward again, you know, eventually.
Sure. All right. Jay Price is our guest here on the WUNC Politics Podcast. We're going to move from D.C. to Raleigh, where this week House Bill 589 was signed into law. Listeners may remember this was an energy bill that took a long time to come together. The business world, the utility community, the environmentalists all came to the same stakeholder meeting that took, from what Politicos tell us, a long time to organize. Essentially, what this bill does is it eases some of the restrictions on solar. It aims to make solar panels, among other provisions, it makes solar panels more readily available, and I think it will make it more affordable for residents throughout the state. So it's an energy bill. However, at the same time, there is a wind moratorium in this bill. Senate leader, Majority Leader Harry Brown, Republican from Onslow County, has long wanted this wind moratorium, initially seeking a four-year moratorium ban on any wind energy projects in the state. Ends up being 18 months. So this happened late in the session where it was passed. The governor signed it this week. He signed the bill and at the same time issues an executive order which says he is asking DEQ, Department of Environmental Quality, to continue recruiting wind energy projects and to also continue the permitting process for wind energy projects during this 18-month ban. So that's kind of the context and a bit of a reminder for the listeners. But of course, the big question, I think, initially for anybody hearing this is, why the heck would they do an energy bill and ban wind for 18 months? Again, Harry Brown, Senate Majority Leader, has long been opposed to this. And this is something that you've done a little bit of reporting on, Jay. He doesn't want wind turbines out near Camp Lejeune because he thinks it's a threat, A, to fighter pilots, and B, could be a threat to having a base closed, either not Camp Lejeune, but Pope Air Force Base. Give us a little bit more of your reporting. What have you learned, and what do you make of those concerns?
Well, you know, what Brown wants is essentially more time for a study to determine where it would be good, bad, or indifferent to place these turbines. You know, these things can be several hundred feet high, and often they are higher than the pilots need to train, depending on where you're located at. There are these kind of weird highways in the sky that the pilots use between the bases and training areas like bombing ranges. And, you know, they want to fly, in many cases, they want to fly close to the Earth to avoid things like radar and to, you know, just get past quickly without being kind of noticed. And if you look at the way that they do these things, these highways are kind of three-dimensional. In places, they have to pop up and over things that are obstructions. So they have these paths, and they're all over. They kind of crisscross the state, and they crisscross most of the country, you know. There's bombing range up in Dare County, for example, that's used a lot by the pilots from Seymour Johnson in Goldsboro for training. The pilots are getting trained in fighter-bomber stuff, and they have to fly low-level passes that are theoretically within, you know, especially once you get right up to the bombing range, are lower than these towers would be, these windmills. Now, so you've got these paths, and then you've got kind of this looming thing called BRAC, the Base Realignment and Closing Commission.
It's out of the Pentagon.
Yeah, well, it's a federal thing, okay. And it's the Pentagon wants to close bases right now. The Pentagon has, depending on how you count it, in the various services, some of them have, you know, 30% or so excess capacity with their footprint, like, you know, too much base, too many buildings here, there, and yon, or the wrong kind of bases and buildings. You know, it's kind of natural. Military evolves over time, and over a period of decades, what they need changes. And so here we are as a nation kind of supporting bases that don't really make a lot of sense for defense. You know, we're having to spend money maintaining them, staffing them, et cetera. And periodically they need to kind of shift things around. You know, it's a big ship and they need to kind of carefully, slowly turn it and change things. But kind of typically Congress opposes these base closing things because these things are economic.
In their districts, right?
You know, you can't imagine Goldsboro without Seymour Johnson Air Force Base. You certainly can't imagine the state without Seymour Johnson, Fort Bragg, Camp Lejeune, Fort Bragg, largest army base by population that we have.
In the country, not just in North Carolina.
Yeah, Lejeune is essentially on par, for the Marines. It is our major East Coast Marine infantry base, and it's a massive and important and crucial base for national defense. There are some bases that are more vulnerable to this than others, though. So we've got Cherry Point and Havelock and Seymour Johnson are smaller bases. It would be easier to close, change them, shrink them down, shift them around in ways that would really hurt the economy. And those places right now are really, they've figured out that keeping their bases healthy, the local officials figured out that keeping their bases healthy is this long game. And it takes a lot of time to make sure that you've got the right land uses around the base to ensure that the military doesn't look at them and say, oh, well, this is, it's just not working out. We have too many apartment buildings too close to the flight path. Eventually, there are always accidents around military bases where they have aircraft, and they need to minimize any sort of impact. So there's this constant question, for example, at Oceana and our corner up in the just over the border from us in the northeast corner of the state, in Norfolk, where they've allowed so much encroachment by buildings, shopping malls, schools, et cetera, that the base is constantly talked about as being imperiled. So periodically these rounds of things come up, and there's talk now of another one as early as 2021. And it would be, potentially they could modify our bases. Now, typically what's happened in recent years is we've gained. The bases are, Lejeune and Fort Bragg are so large and so important and they're using the kinds of force, they have the kinds of military forces now that are really the most useful for the kinds of conflicts that we face. Really light, quick-moving infantry troops. That typically what happens is if they close a base somewhere else, we get their stuff.
Right.
There's this constant risk, and there's this constant belief that the bases are potentially threatened, particularly the smaller ones. So the local officials are constantly trying to figure out ways to make sure that the bases, are viable for the future, not just now, and to make sure that their communities are portrayed as military-friendly and that the state is portrayed as military-friendly so that we gain from BRACs instead of losing. So now, that's the underpinning. The worry the brown states is that if they allow enough of these wind farms, and that it could impact the viability of the bases. Now, that's what he says. There's a military clearinghouse, meanwhile, that of course examines these things. The military wouldn't allow projects like this to be built if it hadn't examined them and determined whether or not it makes sense to put them there.
Right.
They're not going to allow a base to be encircled by wind farms. So there's this kind of dispute over whether what he's talking about makes any sense at all. He and some other opponents of these wind farms have cited these generals and other officers who kind of back channel tell them, these wind farms are a terrible threat to the military's readiness and blah, blah, blah. But somehow these generals never come forward. The excuse during the Obama era was that it would impact their careers, that, Obama was so pro renewables that if they spoke out against them, that it would undercut their careers. Now, they don't have that excuse. I mean, Trump has, Koch brothers folks come into the White House fairly routinely, and you would almost think that a general could get another star for saying renewables are a bad thing.
And generals do use the press sometimes for back channels. You've used generals on back channels before.
Well, it's more like they're using you.
Fair enough.
But yeah, a lot of the top generals will you know, have people in the press that they've cultivated over many years as they come up through the ranks. And, you know, some of those jobs are kind of political too. But, you know, I think basically the folks here are talking about local, you know, officers who were stationed locally and just, you know, just don't want to step forward. It's kind of an odd notion that somebody is willing to sign up, pledge to risk their life for their country, and have the kind of moral underpinning that makes them do that, and yet they won't step forward for something that ostensibly is important for national security, and just say, hey, windmills here, bad idea. You know, and it's this bizarre conflict now too, because the lawmakers who are for the wind power are, you know, in the local districts that are affected are almost uniformly Republican.
Right. We're talking about county commissioners and city council people.
Yeah. And legislators.
Right.
In the affected districts up in the Northeast in particular, where we've got, you know, good potential for wind and a lot of open space. You know, and there are a couple of these folks I've talked to are pretty incensed about this kind of opposition, because they're not great job creators in many ways, but they do generate income. You know, they generate farm income. They put the windmills up on farmland typically, and they make a payment to the landowner, who may not be getting a lot for that land. And they can farm. It doesn't stop farming. The farming can still go on around the base of the thing. They don't really take up a lot of land. Take up a lot of sky, but not a lot of land.
Similar to the LGBT issue, in some ways, I wonder how much of it is playing to one's base and how much of it is really going to be implemented and take effect down the road. Again, this is an 18-month ban. Will there be a proliferation of wind energy in the state come late 2018 or 2019? Who will carry this moratorium down the road? Is Harry Brown going to be around to seek an extension of this? I mean, these are all questions we can't answer right now, but it will be interesting to see if and when there is an influx of wind projects here in the state. We've got a couple more minutes before we go. I wanted to pick your brain for some sort of story. As you have, you said you've aggregate about a year that you were embedded. How many different times is that?
I couldn't even answer that.
I mean, is it like 10 or 12, or is it like 20 or 30?
It's probably on the order of 20, 25, something like that. You know, there were several times where it was a couple of months, month and a half or something like that. But other times, you know, once you're working in one of those places when the war machinery has really cranked up, they have a very large office that serves as kind of a clearinghouse, you know, both in Baghdad and in Kabul. There were places where they had public affairs offices that were just pretty big. Some of them had bunks where the reporters might just be waiting for the next transport out or whatever. And I would be working in the city, you know, kind of outside of the military, and you'd call them and say, hey, you know, I need to do a story down Kandahar way. And they would say, well, you know, it was the most bizarre feeling. It's like you were entering something that was very hard to get into and very hard to get out of. And you would go, you know, you would tell them what you wanted to do. You'd give them written information on that and kind of re-up all your vital statistics with them, you know, social security number, blah, blah, blah. Sign various forms saying things like you wouldn't carry a weapon and this, that, and the other. And what story you were headed for, you know, who you needed to talk with, and they would work with the unit you were headed for to kind of get the logistics dealt with. Then you would, you know, you just kind of enter and then leave. And it, you know, it was a fairly uniform thing many times. You know, the usual things would happen. The transport was usually pretty terrible. I was pretty good at working the transport. Might not be a great reporter, but I was good at logistics, and I could get around pretty well, and I had good patience, which is something that's required for military transport. And, you know, I knew how to go to the right places, I think, for the most part, and how to deal with the stories. There were a lot of fairly uniform experiences. You know, you would kind of know where you're headed and who you needed to talk to. But there were other times when you would just go and just, hey, what's going on around here? Yeah. This is a really interesting part of the war, and we need to figure out what's going on. There's not a lot of reporting out of, say, south of Helmand or whatever. But, you know, kind of the more interesting experiences sometimes were embedding with foreign troops, the Iraqis, in particular, Afghan troops. And later that got to be kind of a dicey thing because of the potential for the Afghans to shoot you. Any sort of opportunity to kill a foreigner, you know, there might be somebody in the unit that was ready to do it.
Right.
So in the later years that I was in Afghanistan, for example, the military couldn't go and spend time with Afghan units without essentially a security detail with them ready to shoot at all times. They, you know, kind of these angels, you would call them. But, you know, the more fun experiences, if any of it could be fun, were spending time with foreign services and seeing how they do things. I spent a lot of time embedded with the Germans up in the north, with Norwegians, the Dutch, who have a very small contingent of folks supporting F-16s up there, and the Mongolians. Who are really interesting. They had showed up in Afghanistan to help out, as it were, without any equipment, without any weapons, without any vehicles.
Warm body.
Yeah. The Germans had taken them on and given them the latest equipment and this and the other, and basically found a role for them serving fixed site security. But, you know, I went to go spend time with them, and it required a ceremony inside of a yurt with this terrible warm milk tea. And
in order for you to serve with them,
in order to spend time with them, walls. They weren't going out on patrol or anything. They were really warmly welcoming, and they had the only Mongolian television channel going. Somehow they'd gotten a feed in to get their shows from back home. Very small outfit, those guys.
What was the toughest part of doing? I mean, you're a print reporter, we should know, every time you've been embedded, right? I mean, what was the toughest part of doing journalism, doing storytelling, and reporting things out? I mean, obviously, it's different than here. I would imagine that you can't just hop in your car and go spend some time with somebody 10, 15 miles away. It's probably not that simple. But what was the biggest hindrance to doing your job?
Well, the biggest hindrance was getting around. Yeah. You know, when things are really bad, you know, in the south of Helmand once, I was with a photographer, and we got stuck in a tiny FOB, the regimental commander.
Sorry, FOB?
Forward Operating Base. Mm-hmm. The regimental commander going into this one, you know, we kind of stopped to talk with senior leaders on our way down to where it was we wanted to go, which was out on a small base. It was a company-sized unit that we wanted to get to. It was about 100, 110 Marines on this base. And it was, I think, the second furthest one they had to the south. And things got progressively more dangerous as you move south. And regimental commander said, well, I know where to send you. You know, I told him what I wanted to see, and I wanted to see what the Marines were doing as far as kind of the winning hearts and minds and nation-building stuff, et cetera. And he said, oh, I know where to send you. I'll send you straight into the jaws of hell. And I'm like, well, you know, you don't have to do many favors, you know. It doesn't have to be quite the jaws of hell. Oh, no, I'll send you there. But... you know, it took a couple of days once we even got to the larger regimental base, took a couple of days to get to this place. And we hadn't been there 5 minutes before the unit took a casualty right outside the gate, and we heard the explosion go off. There were bombs everywhere. The roads were just larded with IEDs. The paths, the bridges had bombs. The compounds that they were going to enter, you know, had bombs kind of walled up in mud on the insides of the door, so you couldn't tell. You know, it's kind of mud walls already, and it's just looks like what the wall looks like. And so they would kind of, one of the methods was to blast a hole in the wall somewhere else to go in. But we never walked on paths, never walked on the road, never walked on bridges. There were canals down there USAID had built many, many years ago while trying to kind of boost the economics of the region. So we'd wade through the canals. We'd walk through the fields rather than take the roads beside them. Dicey place. And the roads were so larded with bombs. It took us, the transport part is what I was getting at here, is the most difficult part. The danger is what it is. But It took, I think, 5 days just to get out of that place to move 6 miles because there were so many bombs, and they kept kind of dealing with bombs when they were running trucks down and back and forth. So we were experiencing kind of the same thing the Marines experienced when they're having to move water around, even, you know. So there was that. With, you know, one of the more difficult things I remember facing is dealing with the Germans, because I have no idea what their relationship is with their own press, but it may not be that good, because they kept questioning my motives. And I was always above board about what I was doing, what stories I was trying to work on, and what I was hearing and what I was interested in. I've always found that, you know, that's the right way to do things, because eventually we'll zoom back and bite you, I'm sure, if you are kind of trying to be sneaky about things. There's, you know, and there's generally no reason to be sneaky. I just tell them, okay, I'm here to examine the kind of process of closing down this base, this kind of famous, and you know, for Germany, they'd suffered a lot of casualties up there, and the process of handing it over to the Afghans, which was a bizarre process. They were having to build a wall down the middle of the base. The Germans had been forced to agree to build this wall down the middle of the base because the two Afghan units that were taking over were so disliked each other and so distrusted each other that they needed about a 12-foot wall between them. The Germans had jokingly dubbed it the Berlin Wall, but it was costing them $900,000. Wow. They'd spent $12 million on the finest dining facility I think I've ever seen. It had an espresso bar, like $30,000 stainless steel doors and things. And they were taking all this beautiful cooking equipment that was brand new and replacing it with holes in the floor where they were going to be cooking with firewood. You know, it was a handover. They had a sewage system that would have served beautifully done, would have served a small city. And they were just like doing away with that. And they're going with two giant septic tanks. So it's just kind of the nature of how things have to be if the Afghans can't maintain all this expensive German stuff. But I told them I was doing this stuff. And they would call me in every day. Yeah. They would call me in every day and say, what is it you're working on? As being kind of interrogated by the German officers. And I would tell them, and they just didn't believe me.
Huh. Oh, that's interesting. Did you, I could go in a number of directions, but I'll save some of my questions for another time. Was there ever a time you were embedded where there was a moment either during your time over there or when you came back and you were just like, nope, I'm not doing this again. This is it for me.
Well, not so much like, you know, the embedding stuff. You know, it's really interesting work. It is really interesting work. And, you know, you can talk to a lot of military folks who have been deployed, and you know, I've talked to any number of them who've been deployed, and once they're cut off from it, really miss it. You're in a microcosm, you have a purpose, and everybody's kind of pulling together in the same way for them, and they, you know, it's what they train for year after year after year, and they finally get to do it. It's not like they're excited about killing people, it's more that they have a purpose and life is stripped away to its essentials. And, you know, but there were moments when I've said, yes, I would never do this again. There were times when I'm not a very good photographer. I'm just not very good at it at all. And it's a skill set that is, you know, you can get as good at it as you can stand. You know, you can get a PhD basically, you know, in photography, right, and spend your whole life on it. But there was a time I was in Fallujah, and basically I was embedded with a very small Marine unit. And moreover, as I guess you could say, I was more embedded with an Iraqi Army unit that they were mentoring. So there, we would go out on patrol, and there would be 2-3 Marines and 15 or 20 Iraqis. And because I was having to shoot my own pictures, you can't walk behind because you can't just take pictures of the backs of people's heads. So I had to walk point for Iraqi patrols, basically, in Fallujah when things were fairly bad. And I only did that a couple of times before. I was like, no, this doesn't make sense. My photographs are not good, you know.
Risk-reward.
And the risk is very high. The Iraqis were not very good marksmen, and if something had gone wrong, there's a good chance they would have plugged me. Conversely, where the bomb could have got me in the front, or the sniper could have got me from the other side, there was a lot of downside to that one. So
sounds like it. Yeah.
So I'm not walking point for Iraqi patrols. I'm done with this. It was a bad place. The Iraqi's commander had been badly injured the week before I got there by a bomb, you know, while they were out on patrol, and it just didn't make any sense. The stories were okay, but they weren't that good.
Is there anywhere you would like to do military reporting overseas that you have not yet been?
Oh, somewhere with French food. I joke with the 82nd Commanding General one time. It's just they never seem to invade anywhere with, you know, good food. You know, that's almost like saying, "Well, where do you want us to invade and destroy next?" You know, no. It would be preferable if we didn't do wars anymore, if there was no need for it. That's, you know, that's what I would like to see. Now, as far as like civilian/training type stories, I like travel Southeast Asia. It's good people, good traveling, interesting part of the world. If we're ever doing a training story in Cambodia or Laos, I hope they send me.
Okay. We'll run that up the flagpole. We will leave it there for now, save some stories for the next time we do this. Jay, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And thank you as well for tuning in. If you liked, loved, or even hated this podcast, give us a rating on iTunes, Google Play, and or Stitcher, wherever it is that you get your podcasts. You can subscribe there as well. State lawmakers return to Raleigh next Thursday. You can get updates on all of the happenings at our website, wunc.org. For Jay Price, I'm Jeff Tiberi. Thanks for tuning in. Enjoy your weekend. We'll